Yeah, hello, dear listeners of the Education Newscast, for another show, another episode. Today, again, in English, and we talk about a very interesting topic. It's about how inclusive AI cultures relate to the future of work, to transformation. And I'm very happy to have Professor Payal Arora today on the show. You did many talks and presentations about that, also OEB in Berlin. So unfortunately, it was not possible to meet, but I hope that I can ask you some questions today about the presentation, about your book. We will also talk about that. So, hey, great that you're here today.
Thanks, Thomas. It's lovely to be here. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, perhaps could you briefly introduce yourself? So who are you? What's your journey so far?
Sure. So I'm, as you mentioned, a professor of inclusive AI cultures, which is, of course, fitting to the podcast, but I am based at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. I also wear multiple hats, also a co-founder of a lab called Inclusive AI Lab, which does a sort of unique construction of helping build products, services, and platforms for, the majority world. And much of that is also, of course, educational technologies, everyday learning and teaching. And what's unique about it is we have a mix of industry experts, academic experts, and civic experts from around the world who come together, and we basically serve as a platform to bring them together so we can problem solve and innovate in a way which can be ethical, sustainable, and more inclusive. Because I think, at this point, we need all hands on board for such an undertaking, which is formidable if you stay restricted to your sector or your particular discipline. You kind of restrain yourself from new ideas.
Yeah, and I hope all you listeners, you also find that very interesting, inspiring, because we talked quite often already about AI in the podcast and different perspectives, but never we looked on ethics and especially the topics what you touch. So perhaps we just can start, let's say, more first defining the subject a little bit. So what do you understand under inclusive AI culture? What does that mean after all?
Yeah, so interestingly, this morning I was giving a keynote at the UNESCO event for, the International Day of Education, which I think this is fitting for this podcast, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a coincidence that the UNESCO theme for today and for this year is AI, agency, and automation. So there's this larger panic about how AI is going to replace teachers. It's going to destroy the classroom. It's going to destroy what we know as education without actually taking a pause for the fact that education as we know it needs a real overhaul, right?
Absolutely.
We do need disruption because we're functioning from a model from a century ago, right? The sort of, dissemination model of one to many. And when you have this kind of model, then inclusion becomes a formidably challenging task. I mean, just think about social linguistics, right? The fact that how do you teach in multiple languages? In countries maybe which are more monolinguistic, it's not an issue. But say in countries like in India, where you have 22 regional languages and you have 18,000 to 20,000 dialects, and then you add even more of the informal dialects, and that becomes an impossibility, actually. So AI can enable for personalized learning in ways that were impossible, actually, even a year ago, right? So we are talking about inclusion in a sort of deeply structural way by allowing access to material, content, knowledge, speakers, translations of, work in ways which used to be, again, formidably expensive, right? So that's just on the linguistic level. Mm-hmm. We haven't even tapped into the fact that people can connect with one another and are learning and teaching on a variety of different spaces outside of the classroom. So, I think when I speak about inclusion, like I mentioned, is that we have to go beyond these rubrics where we believe learning and teaching take place, Again, for example, I noticed at UNESCO, they emphatically talked about the classroom, but it's really the classroom is just one of the many spaces where young people are learning, particularly in the majority world, because many of the times teachers are not showing up, or they don't have text materials or reading materials, or that, you know, parents are trying to work multiple jobs and they can't go for continuous ongoing learning, but they do need to upskill. So they're learning in the little pockets of time online to upskill themselves through different channels. I think if we don't expand the repertoire of how people are learning and teaching and how deeply personalized it is happening, we can also tap into the insights that we're getting on what are people really seeking to upskill about. So we can even reverse it and we can sort of teach ourselves about what people are trying to upskill, which gives us a sort of policy insight, right, on what we need to do from, say, if you're a policy maker, you know, this is a very important metadata, actually. But yeah. I'll stop here. It's a sort of a, you know, it's like unraveling of a garment, and you start to pull out the thread and then you start talking more and more. But you get a glimpse of what I'm, you know, talking about and going towards.
Yeah. So if you look about learning and development in corporations, I think the stuff what you learn at schools, that's perhaps absolutely basis. But if you look how people learn in corporations, it's about collaboration. It's about really learning on the job. And in the end, we need to have a framework about that or support that. But I would have another question. So what you stress also, and of course this relates pretty much to inclusion, is the role of the global south. And that's perhaps just my interpretation. I think a lot of, let's say, also software and now also the large language models, they were developed, let's say, by people, Western people, many even from the Silicon Valley. Of course, that's not inclusive. So it's pretty much biased. Also, if you look what data was available for training that models, is that what you mean? How to include or be more inclusive towards the global South? Or
yeah. So look, we are living in a world in a systems, and we operate with, you know, everyday tools and services which are intrinsically biased, because you know, for the longest time we've designed for us a very small segment of the world. You know, typical, like, we have this acronym called WEIRD, right, which is, I don't know if people have heard of that. It basically stands for Western Educated Industrialized Rich Democratic Nations. So the WEIRD acronym basically is what we typically think about when we are developing policy platforms, tools, and then we export it to the rest. And then, of course, you add to that, you know, the male universality, where whether it's in the medical sciences, whether it's the shape of the phone, right, to fit into the male hand, or metabolic, you know, rates are usually pegged to the male for, say, temperature of rooms. I mean, it cuts across board. And, or like, if you're designing safety tools, it's usually male dummy, not a female. So, I mean, I can go on with these examples. So you have the gendered component, you have the global north component. So, and there's also no such thing as zero bias. There's no ground truth of zero bias, right? There'll always be bias. So what do we do with that? Is that indeed you have large language models, which of course are biased because it's basically built on data sets from the past. And the past, as we know, this history comes with deep biases because of socioeconomic inequalities, which have been persistent over a very long time. So how do we prevent that from reproducing it, particularly in these AI models? Is there is an opportunity for, as we see by the Global South, to build, like, say, even small language models where they are catering in their own dialects in hyper-localized ways. You have hundreds of, you know, to thousands of, like, African entrepreneurs building, like, large language, not large language models, but small language models in their dialects, right? So they can create textbooks in Swahili or in other kinds of languages then print it out with images for kids in these different regions that didn't have textbooks in the past. So, and that could also be biased, but the question is that it's always in relation to what, right? Mm-hmm. So if you are in the global south, you're basically the majority in the world, because it's something that is well worth keeping in mind that 90% of young people in the world today live in these regions. So that is the majority world, right? And in fact, it's just going to particularly grow rapidly in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. That's where the future generations are coming from. And, you know, using these spaces. And even when you build bias tools and data sets, it shifts based on the way in which it gets engaged with. Because we know that the engagement is also material that these AI tools are learning from. So you can come up with your bias, but these engagements, say, for example, on Instagram, I'm able to finally tell my story, right? Like I'm a plumber in, you know, South Africa, and I use my Instagram channel to, you know, give you my insights about why I think crypto is great. And I have my own channel because I'm a self-anointed, you know, teacher online. And maybe because I'm more accessible and I'm more relatable, I can get hundreds of thousands of followers, and I become inadvertently an influencer and a legitimate role model for the way in which I can upskill others like me, who is, you know, basically got a manual job, but understands the urgency of crypto because my currency is very weak and I don't trust the government. And that's just a snapshot, right, of what is going on out there, is that we have a lot of people who are educating the world. They just don't have an official certification. They are anointed by their followers and they have a platform, and we can't dismiss that easily. And it's sort of democratizing in a way, because, I mean, you know, there is something about a value that people are getting. And I, you know, it could be about how do you make a living given you are in very constrained settings? Say you're in a war zone. Mm. How do you deliver goods? And you have a channel for that. And how do you cope with that? So it's not just some sort of mental health, like kumbaya, like you can do it. No, there are everyday strategies of here are the routes, these are what you can do. And that's what you can call professional development, right? So I'm just really expanding the spectrum of what learning and teaching is looking like across different platforms by teachers who are not typically trained but are self-anointed. And how do we account for them, but also understand that that can also create a serious danger sometimes of miseducation or, you know, disinformation, right? And I'm not undermining that issue, you know? So it's both realities are very much there, and we need to recognize that it has deep potential for enablement, but needs to be crafted in ways which are, you know, safeguarding people's interests.
So what would be your, let's say, call to action or your recommendation then to perhaps even to listeners, let's say, to foster more diversity, for example, tech development? Of course, hey, if someone from OpenAI or Anthropic or Google is listening, it's probably hard to influence these big players, but of course, everyone has his or her contribution, right? So what would be your good practices or recommendations to foster more diversity?
Well, one is that we are building data sets, but we are building data sets based on what we assume the rest of the world want to know. And we assume the rest of the world needs to know, right? And so whether it's curriculum of certain kind, sometimes deliberate, sometimes not deliberate, right? And I think so when we have this buzz term co-design, it's basically, you know, it comes down to trying to connect with people on the ground, you know, who've got their feet wet, by connecting, also even observing who are these rising educational influencers, right? In fact, if you think about actually what are the most common prompts on these platforms is how do I do some X, Y, Z? You know, these are autocomplete, but it's actually across platforms, whether it's TikTok, they realize even Pornhub, by the way, had one of the biggest channels. They, in fact, set up their own channel on education because people were even getting on Pornhub for understanding about their sexuality. Like, sex education was taking place on Pornhub, right? And that's because it doesn't take place in most parts of the global south because it's tabooed. People don't talk to young people about sex and sexuality, not schools. Mm. There is no sex education programs. Or if there are sex education programs, say, in many parts of the global south, it's more about abstinence and it's religious driven.
Mm.
It doesn't really give information to young people about what is healthy. Because, you know, think about how we felt when we were teenagers. Imagine you have no idea what's coming. And, you know, if you're a kid, a girl in Pakistan, and you start to menstruate for the first time and nobody's ever told you this. And nobody still talks to you about it, or they feel it's a taboo subject. So the mother tells you something which is more shame-filled, like you better hide yourself, you better do this. And you don't quite know why, what's going on. And, you know, in that regard, these kinds of tools can be very, very powerful to understand. And because there's a lot of subjects you just cannot explore with teachers, your peers. Mm. And this is what AI-enabled learning tools can provide, mm-hmm. is this sort of safe space to explore learning of what impacts your life very immediately, very viscerally. And that's just one segment, right? So yeah, I mean, we need to really pay attention to what people are looking for. We have if you're a big company, you have the metadata. And in fact, they are listening through that metadata, right? Because that really disrupts your perceptions. And whether it's, you know, Netflix or any of these, these are not just entertainment portals.
Mm.
They are realizing these are also educational portals.
And you mentioned co-design, for example, as one, let's say, good practice. Can you elaborate on that? What does it mean? Or perhaps you can give an example.
Yeah. So, for example, if you are recognizing that through the metadata that there's a lot of interest in certain kinds of communication. So, say if you're a policymaker, okay, in education, and you're trying to encourage certain kind of public awareness programs, right? And so the metadata reveals what is commonly perceived. Maybe they think if you masturbate, you're going to go to hell. So you have to, like, how do you, or that you have wrong notions of healthcare, right? So how, you know how to, what is your launching points, right? In terms of how do you educate kids by understanding what are the common misinterpretations, misinformation out there. Or it could be about climate or the environment or about, you know, a variety of different topics. So in a way, this is a very interesting way of curriculum development,
mm-hmm.
for which, you know, we can think as a critical resource, because what this is market analysis, but at a very mega level, and the analysis is already taking place by AI, and it is extraordinarily feasible. This is something which is normally exorbitantly expensive to do if you had to do it at that scale across different cultural contexts, right? So I think there's that as an opportunity. Another could be a very interesting critical thinking where you can use this sort of cross-cultural analysis, because what we do have now is metadata and amazing amount of insights on how different cultures perceive certain topics. And in this day and age of geopolitics and tensions, it would be very insightful to sort of, you know, engage in a cross-cultural way, because we really need to do some peace building. We are extraordinarily fragmented. And if you're committed to this kind of peace building, we need to think in geopolitical terms. We cannot insulate ourselves, right? So there are so many opportunities to do this, right?
And in the end, it's just about communication. And one thing what you also mentioned is the role of community engagement in developing inclusive AI technology. So could you shed some light on that? So, or perhaps even an example, is it more about cross-cultural communities, or what do you mean with that?
Yeah, so at the Inclusive AI Lab, we're doing a number of projects on this. For example, we worked with a number of young people in disability groups and organizations in India, and we're scaling it to Kenya and Ecuador and other contexts, but also rural girls. And a lot of them don't get really recognized in terms of their insights, because even in India, there's a divide between the urban and the rural. Mm. Even the majority of the Indians live in the rural area. Same case, by the way, with many parts of whether it's Latin America, Africa, Asia, is the rural tends to be forgotten in curriculum development and ed tech. They tend to like focus on an urban middle class elite. Mm. And, you know, in the end of the day, if you're, say, an ed tech product designer, right? You know, there is still that model of scalability. If you know that, you know, the economy of scale, where you have a majority of populations living in, you know, contexts like tier two, tier three towns and rural areas, it's normally very hard to get access to how they think, what they need. And for finally, because data plans and digital tools have become much more affordable in the last decade, where today, in fact, mobile internet is some of the cheapest in countries like Vietnam, Cambodia, you know, Israel, and other contexts, it is disrupting how we think about, you know, the digital divide. So there's finally a chance we can gain insight. So Inclusive AI Lab did this project where the girls were able to experiment with generative AI visual tools to see how they get represented, how their community gets represented. And they realized they were pretty invisible on the maps, on Google Maps, in images. They had deep stereotypes actually of a one carpet industry. Like, you know, we did it in Rajasthan. So it was this one carpet industry that dominated it and romanticized. So we kind of worked with them to build visual data sets to populate in the Creative Commons. And that became not just an action-based project, but it became a pedagogic exercise where we were on one hand building a data set through the Creative Commons, but also getting them to map out what matters to them, like water towers and tanks so they can access water, or, you know, a library. Basically, it was the tools are being designed for themselves and not as a PR for some rug company that is catering to a diasporic international, you know, Indian group that lives in the US. Mm. And that is a game changer in terms of who are you building these AI tools for, and also reclaiming some aspect of your agency through this kind of, I would say, action research and education, right?
Yeah, now just many things pop in my head. So quite some years ago, I did some cross-cultural research on learning styles and values. And it's similar what you mentioned. So even between people working or living in China from big cities and who were at, let's say, more Western universities, the similarity is much closer between Germans and Chinese than if you compare it to rural areas. So your call to action would be to do, let's say, to change also, let's say, the research, and then also how you build the user interfaces or how you roll out and onboard apps, for example, or?
Yeah, I think, you know, the thing is we tend to segment what we do, like we put education in a box, you know, and I feel like it cuts across. It becomes like the project I described is pedagogic exercise. It's, you know, you could say it's a classroom, it's a workshop or exercise. On the other hand, it's also a debiasing data set initiative, right? Because we are reviving the Creative Commons and diversifying it. It becomes an activist, you know, project. And it also becomes a sort of a reclamation to, you know, these tools which are deeply actually localized. Because it actually, when people talk about, oh, how do I localize EdTech? Well, it sounds all buzzy about the local and global, and it doesn't mean that, oh, if you are, you know, Nigerian and you're building the EdTech tool, then thereby it is localized. No, you could very well be a typical Nigerian group building tools for the US, which is commonly the case, right? So I think it's a different way in which to create more sovereignty, more agency, and also more awareness across, you know, across these kinds of areas.
And do you have some examples of apps who did that well? So perhaps people from the listeners think about EdTech, of course, the typical suspects like Duolingo or Khan Academy. Also, they're these typical suspects, yeah, which actually mainly come also from the Western, yeah. But do you have some examples perhaps, which are not that well known who did that well?
Well, in terms of EdTech, not specifically, but I know a number of initiatives, like, say, for example, Lilapa AI is a South African group that is building small language data models and are in their own dialects and doing these hyper-localized problem solving based on, because of that. So they don't intend to scale globally. Not everything has to scale globally.
Okay.
But it can be optimal enough to be sustainable. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it is an interesting initiative. You have a number of these kinds of initiatives. And then you have in India, you have these very targeted upskilling tools for editors, you know, where you can leverage on AI to speeden up your editorial work and, you know, come up with quality added value to your clients who tend to be around the world in Australia, etc. So that's actually really interesting. So I think one of the ways in which these countries are gaming it is that they know they can't get in with the, they don't have these extraordinary deep resources. And if you follow what's happening now with Trump doubling down on investing billions into this, it becomes even more of a divide between who gets to control these data sets. But, you know, these efforts of what we do with these foundational models and tailor it to very specific localized targets. Like it could be sectoral, like I am a journalist, I am stretched to my bandwidth and I need, instead of taking hours in finding out, you know, and schooling myself on material, here are some sort of quick tutorials with AI that I can help, you know, build my article, or it can do this proofreading. So it's sort of like a in my regional language with this particular sort of localized data set, right? Because my audience is from these regions. So these are the kinds of initiatives that are taking place, which, you know, may seem small and humble, but when you have thousands of them, you know, disseminating and expanding, you know, exponentially, it can be a game changer as they aggregate over time, right?
And perhaps also leverage more open source, let's say, offerings, and not only, let's say, the typical suspects like from the large Silicon Valley companies. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, so you have this digital public infrastructures in India where you can actually build, any entrepreneur can build their app without paying the sort of, you know, 20% iOS or whatnot fee to iOS, Android, but you can, as an entrepreneur, build your app on open source, open code. And, you know, it's linked to the fintech app, which is also, you know, open source. So you can actually bring multiple tools together where you can actually make it viable. So there's a lot of experimenting going on. Also data light, because this takes a lot of energy, right? And we know that already these sort of resources, whether it's water to cool data centers, et cetera, is extraordinarily scarce in most parts of the world. And so this also is taking into account these to make it much more feasible. So it is very strategic in terms of the way in which it uses data, which, by the way, is a great solution for going forward if we want to address some of the most formidable, you know, questions of how do we reduce the energy consumption of these data centers while we're building inclusive tools, right?
You mentioned you're also doing quite some research in your lab. So anything what lately surprised you from types of results, regarding results, I mean?
Yeah, so we were working with, you know, disability groups in India mm-hmm. on representation and how would they like to be, you know, how do they take control of their own representation in these data sets? And what was interesting is that in the curation techniques, they were, you know, it's how they see themselves, and they see themselves as people who are deeply social. Affect is very important. So when we think about, oh, representation of disability, we think, okay, well, more people on wheelchairs or, you know, people with sticks. Mm. We have very stereotypical notions of how we think disability groups should be represented. And for them, the way in which we got them to talk about it is we got them to use generative AI visual tools to see how AI generates them if they give prompts. And almost all the visual tools out there using generative AI techniques were basically coming up with deep stereotypes of some person on the wheelchair,
absolutely,
looking at a sunset, isolated and abandoned. Mm. It is all very, very depressing. Mm. And so,
can imagine. It's with everything. Also, if you want to make pictures of women or also of men, it's very, very stereotype. Absolutely. Yeah.
Exactly. So basically, they wanted us to build more where they are laughing and they're connecting with each other.
Mm.
So they're much more nuanced, right? That they wanted to be in among people and to show that there was a two-way engagement. So it has to be visually represented. And I think that it's not just the visual representation, but it's also a great exercise of empathy building and, you know, understanding different groups, because there's a lot of learning about our emotional intelligence, which tends to get neglected and deprioritized over the IQ, right?
But it's a basic human values in the end, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And perhaps before we come to an end, many of the listeners are coming from learning and development, from change management, whatever, freelancers working in corporations, mainly, let's say, in the German-speaking area in Europe. So do you have a call to action, also, let's say, out of your point of view, what they can do?
Yes. So basically, I feel that, you know, I've been engaging in the German space for quite a while. And I've already been in Germany many times this year. And I've got a, you know, feeling that I was at Republica to, you know, of course, OEB and many other big events. And I noticed that one of the running threads was this deep despair about the future. There's this deep, like, it's very fear-driven. And I think this kind of mentality is not going to help us move forward, because if you're not excited about these possibilities, you know, if you're not seeing the true potential, and I hope by coming up with these examples, the listeners will get just a glimpse of what these tools are doing to the majority world. It can infuse them with some kind of optimism that this is not just all these are oppressive, extractive tools. And if they're developing it, that there's almost this guilt-ridden, you know, feeling that, oh, maybe, you know, I don't know why I'm even doing this, or I'm finding a struggle on how meaningful this is. So I get that kind of group who is doing this because they have to, but they're not convinced themselves because they are also reading the media, which says they're bad people for extracting, etc. So you have that story. On the other hand, also you feel, I see a lot of risk averse mentality by saying, well, let me just be on the safe side and build tools and services for the usual suspects. Because we are in such uncertain times, that the fear makes us become even more inward looking, when in reality, because of these uncertain times of disruption, this creates a lot of opportunity to play an out of the rule book, right? And so I think if we can use this as an opportunity to shift our status quo, I think we could really do something amazing.
So to be more optimistic, more creative, less risky.
Okay.
And like I mentioned, it's just tools like a hammer or a saw. So you can hurt someone with tools, but you can also build great things.
Of course. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So I have three short questions to you. So what is your narrative for learning and development? Do you have an own personal narrative?
Tell fresh stories that can inspire change.
And what's on your to-learn list currently? What are you learning today or this year?
I'm trying to diversify my culinary skills.
That's cool.
I'm trying to cook different kinds of food and talking about breaking, my risks. So.
And your recommendations for further resources? So you lately published a book, so we put that in the show notes, From Pessimism to Promise. But any other things, perhaps also what you use for updating yourself, for upskilling yourself?
I think there's this wonderful magazine called Rest of World, and it really gives an amazing perspective on the majority world, but it's open for entrepreneurs, tech people, you know, just people who are curious about the world, but not in sort of aid agency kind of ethos. It's really about, okay, here's what Mexico is doing in these really interesting ways. And it's always disruptive, or stories from the ground, deep investigative journalism. It's an excellent resource. And I think people would really benefit from it.
Okay, great. I researched that and put it in the show notes. So our listeners, check it out. And perhaps just some final words on OEB. So as you have been there, so next OEB is at the 3rd to 5th December in Berlin again. So I try to be there. So call for proposals. Let's say if you want to do a presentation there, that starts in March. So I also put the OEB link in the show notes. Yeah, having said that, thanks so much for the talk. I thought it's very inspiring. I already have another, let's say, appointment for a podcast show to tackle the topic of ethics in AI. I think that's very important, responsible AI, and also consideration of ethics. So thanks so much for sharing your insights, also for the inclusive topic. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And thanks all listeners. Yeah. Like mentioned, we put some content in the show notes, also the LinkedIn profile. So having said that, wishing all of you a great further day. Bye.